brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target, and I guess I'm going to reveal that we're, you know, recording two shows at once here, so I do apologize
This is our Thanksgiving special.
Yeah.
So we're recording early so we can all take Thanksgiving off, but at the same time, we're getting this podcast out to coincide with the release of J.T. Patton's new book, Buried in Black.
Which, by the way, I will give credit to Jack. I was like, yeah, we'll just run a best of. And you're like, no, let's do two shows with J.T. Patton on. And by the way, because I was like running through stuff for these past two shows, you hear the theme song through your headphones, right?
I do.
Cool. Is that your first time hearing it? Because it's been a while since you've been on.
You know, I don't remember. I know that I listened to the show so much, so I'm used to that. But
okay.
I think it has been, 2016 since I was on?
Okay, it's been a few years.
I guess I'm slow kicking out the books, but... But yeah, no, it sounds great.
Yeah, it's been a while. As I always say, very Top Gun-esque. I did ask John Burns, which you guys could visit at johnburnsband.com, B-Y-R-N-E-S. I was like, let's go with something that sounds like the Top Gun theme, but not so much that we get kicked off platforms for copyright infringement. So that was really the essence behind the song. But anyway, I think a ton of our audience know who J.T. Patton is. Former counterterrorism intelligence advisor and thriller writer. And he has a book out today as we're recording this, which is Buried in Black. And it's the first in a brand new series.
Correct. So it's, I had been an indie publisher, and this was the first one that's kicked off through Kensington and through their Lyrical Press. So I guess I'm to a certain degree running with the big dogs, and we'll just see if I can keep up.
Yeah, it's awesome. I read your previous works, when we talked about them on the last podcast. The new book, Buried in Black, I have it. I'm 200 pages into it, which maybe it's a good thing. I can't blow the ending for anybody, because I don't know, but I think just like your last books, which I was fascinated by, and the kind of take you had on counterterrorism operations and intelligence operations, this one is definitely in the same vein. It's not the same experience you would get from reading, let's say, a Dalton Fury novel or Jack Murphy novel for that matter. I mean, this is something different. It's something darker too. So I'll let you tell us a little bit about what the book is about. Go ahead and you tell us about the book, and then we'll get into some other things.
Okay, sounds good. Well, the one thing that you did bring up that was, I think, kind of interesting is, you know, putting yourself out there and Dalton Fury. And of the books that are out there in the military thriller genre, or subgenre, I think that I get more accolades from people who like those type of books or those authors, you know, yourself included. They are darker. They are a lot more gritty. They are hard hitting. I'd say that's where I fit in, is in that real gray and morass and really a lot of the brutality. I think to a large degree, that's where there wasn't a huge palette for some of the earlier works that I had in the publishing world, because quite frankly, they said it was just too dark.
It's not a lot of flag waving.
No. I think that's what I'm hoping to bring of it. I'm hoping to bring my background being from the intelligence side and mission support. It's not like the espionage novels of, John le Carré, and some of the others that are a lot more, you know, the smiley, long, drawn out, not a whole lot of action going on. But yet it's also not quite just Bourne, you know, where you've got this guy who's just unstoppable running everywhere. It's how do you fit intelligence into ops, put them on the ground, and what happens when some of the intel operators are called to work direct action. Really, it's a lot of, I think, what we've seen in the last 6 to 8 years with the wars that are going on. But I think that there, for whatever reason, the genres or subgenres are still kind of split. You know, you've either got to be one or you've got to be the other one. And as we know, the adage of intel is ops, ops is intel, I think that's where I like to be. Buried in Black is very similar, only when I was starting out the new series with Kensington, you know, they wanted something different from what's out there. And, but yet they wanted to have kind of what I brought to the table, with the intelligence kind of fusion side of things. And I think there's plenty of books out there with Delta Force operators, SAD and, sorry, I got a
dude's doing aircraft takedowns and direct action raids in Afghanistan or, you know, and some of those authors are very good. You know, I've spoken, you know, very highly of, you know, the Dalton Fury books. I love them. I think what your books are a little bit more about is intelligence driven operations. And I guess I think what you're writing about is what a lot of people see as the future of counterterrorism into the next decade is what you're talking about, that fusion of intelligence and operations, and it ends up in a very gray place.
Yeah, I think so. And I think as you're bringing in the technology to things, and again, you know, the SEAL Team 6 and Delta books, I love them. I read them myself, but I couldn't come up with something that was that much different.
Right. Right.
The other thing of it is that I, you know, like many others, I'm held down by, publication review. And so there is a certain degree of what I can't even put out there. And so one of the things that was nice about, writing about Task Force Orange or the intelligence support activity is it's one of the few JSOC elements that I wasn't formally read into. So I felt like I had a little bit of leeway there where even if maybe I had worked with a program office or something like that, and that's the type of thing that they were doing, I thought that I could take enough of the history, things that are out there in the public, and just, you know, put out there, okay, here's what this element does, and then put it into kind of a newer crafted type of a storyline that takes, you know, the UAVs, the hacking and the jamming, and then still bring in, you know, regular human tradecraft and of course the direct action that's part of it. So it really kind of a fun place to be.
Well, I was wondering if you could explain for the listeners, in the beginning of the book, you mentioned that essentially what your book is about, what Buried in Black is about waived unacknowledged special access programs. And I was wondering if you could explain to people, what does that term mean when you hear that? I mean, I think most people are familiar with the term top secret, but you're talking about something a little bit deeper, more compartmentalized than that even.
Yeah, very much so. So, I mean, as you know, with the various classifications and then you have various, you know, read-ins to certain programs, and there are some programs, where you get into acknowledged, where, you know, people do recognize. So you're now getting into more of the covert activities, where there's some things that people are just not going to acknowledge. And there are certain levels of this, so that deepness into those operations where even, you know, congressional oversight isn't going to be part of it. So it's, you know, it's unacknowledged. We're not going to acknowledge that those things exist, and it's waived from having any oversight. So this is kind of the deep in the bowels, so to speak, of programs. I laugh because there were certain buildings that I might have gone into in the past to do some work. And even though you're in the SCIF, even though you're at a certain level of compartmentalization, you know, you're still kind of brought into like the broom closet to have some discussions about some programs and some projects that are going on. And that's, you know, really from that vantage that I'm taking it is you've got what everybody else knows, even when they think that they're running kind of dark projects. But then there's that other layer, which is the hey, let's get this guy in there. And I think that's where some of this ambiguity and the confusion even comes in operating is there are times when you don't even ask who is the owner of this program. You know, you don't even ask what the mission is of it. You just, you know, somebody brought you in and said, hey, grab this guy. You know, in my case, they may have said, you know, he can help you get in or get out of a place or do some of the covert support. And, you know, you don't even ask who the guys are. You may be introduced. You may see some familiar faces. But you just don't ask. So I think that where the books are that I write is, you know, what if you're tasked? What if you really don't know what it is or you kind of get a general sense of it? But, you know, you just kind of going through that operation mentality mindset of the environment where, you know, don't ask, don't tell. And you just kind of assume, hey, if you've been brought into the loop, you know, you're in the enough know that you need to be in.
Well, with the unacknowledged program, I think it's interesting that the people who are read onto it, they cannot respond with no comment. They have to respond, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
Even if it could be their own boss in certain situations that asks them, hey, what have you ever heard of this program? And they have to look at their boss dead in the eye and say, I've never heard of that before.
Right. Right. And again, I've never been in those situations where somebody delineates that this is one of those things that you have to say no to. It's just, there are just some things that you're involved with where you just know you shut the hell up. You don't say anything to anybody, which is hard because you might be involved with it with somebody else and they might ask you and say, hey, I know that you're involved with it. And that's where the counterintelligence standpoint goes in. You're like, I don't even know if you were read into this too. You know, it's kind of informal. And so you end up going back, checking with somebody and saying, hey, you know, does this person, you know, have that need to know, or are they involved also?
Well, speaking of those conversations in the mop closet, in the broom closet, I remember we had recently on Sean Parnell, and we were having a conversation about weird stuff that's kind of beyond what we typically refer to as tier one operators, that there are like these little levels above that. And we were having this conversation about how sometimes, you know, a ranger patrol is out doing something and they get told, hey, swing by this grid location and meet this dude. Right. And some guy just comes walking down off the side of the mountain, white guy with a beard, punches up something on his laptop and gives it to you. And you take it back to the base for somebody. It's like these weird things that come into your operations laterally. Like, hey, while you're out there, go do this or drop this guy off or take this one guy out with you and he's going to go walk around the market while you're out on your patrol and then come back and you bring him back with you. And it's just weird shit, for lack of a better term, but it's actual operational stuff that's taking place that's being punched into normal operations in a lateral fashion.
Right, right. And to be clear, you know, I was never the guy who was walking out there, you know, that Mr. Smith or that Mr. White,
right?
That just happens to be, you know, my role in, you know, covert support and mission support activities were how to get that guy into that place or how to get that guy out of that place, how to make them look like the local, or if they have to have some money coming in or going out, you know, what are we doing to support that? And so I think there too, you know, coming from the intelligence side, I know that I'm not the same level of operator as those guys are going to be. And so when you are having those discussions, you know, you just know there's a guy who's sitting there at the end of the table or sitting in there in the corner and they're saying, hey, can you do this? Can you do this? And you're kind of like, well, I think I can. But you recognize that guy in the room is going to be the person that's got to actually do it. So it's got a little bit of a pressure, but that's also where, you know, you whatever you're saying that you can do or whatever you figure out, you got to figure out how that can happen without even asking for a lot of help to get, you know, whatever needs to be done.
I mean, it's odd to think about, but I tell these stories sometimes about when I was in the Army and I'd be asked to do things that I felt were beyond my capabilities, but it was also great because they put this responsibility on you, like being asked to do aerial platform support with a sniper rifle in Afghanistan. I'm like, what the hell? I've never done that. How does that work? And you have to like ask your squad leader to teach you how to do that real quick before you actually go out and do it. I mean, did you encounter situations like that in the intelligence world like what you were just mentioning, where some guy comes to you and is like, hey, can you do this and that? And it's kind of like, it's all on you, brother. Like, you got to figure it out and hopefully you don't screw it up. And especially if it's a compartmentalized program, I mean, you can't ask for anyone else's help.
Yeah, there's a saying that Richard Branson says. I saw him one time, which is, you know, if somebody presents you with an opportunity, you know, seize it and figure out how to do it later. You're messing with people's lives, but admittedly, there are a number of times when I said, "Oh, absolutely, we can do that." And if it's getting somebody indiscreetly into a certain country or setting up a business in another location, yeah, we can do that. No problem. You walk out there, there's a serious pucker factor of, well, let's figure it out. But I think that while there may be a little bit of, you know, some ego to that or just a desire to be part of something and doing it, I think there was a realistic element to it where I did believe that I would do everything possible and go further than most other people would be, so that if I said, no, I can't do it, and they went to somebody else, I firmly believe that for the type of work that I was doing, I was going to be one of the top that they could find to get that stuff done.
The protagonist of your new book, Buried in Black, is a guy who served in, you know, one of these compartmentalized programs and was working for a unit that's commonly referred to as the intelligence support activity. We'd sometimes call them TFO, Task Force Orange. You know, all the special operations units like Rangers or Task Force Red, they all had colors. I know you know this, but some of our listeners might not. Task Force Orange was ISA or a certain part of ISA. And that's probably the organization within special operations that we talk the least about. I mean, because they're very small and they're very secretive and you don't necessarily know what those guys are up to. So, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about what this organization is?
Sure. I'll say what my general public understanding is of the organization, which is it's intelligence support to activities, or it's actually conducting those activities. It largely grew out of the hostage taking in Iran years back. And afterwards, you know, there was some talk of, can you focus on a unit that can do that type of a support, focusing not only on the human intelligence side, but also bring in the technology. So the signals intelligence, you know, the communications intelligence. So you're wrapping that up to be that entity that you can do advanced force operations with and be the kind of the first guys in, blending into that social fabric. But also doing a lot of the real nitty gritty technical things. So if you've read any of the books about killing Pablo, you know, the Pablo Escobar and the support that they gave to DEA, there's a lot of work that has been done and reported on about Lebanon against Hezbollah. So that type of work is really, you know, it seems to blend in now to a lot of missions that that Delta might take on, but there was more of the focus at the time of the signals intelligence capability from, you know, what's been reported out there.
I mean, in addition to the operational preparation of the environment stuff that they've been brought on to do, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the main reasons why they were created was because the Army needed tactical intelligence as opposed to the strategic intelligence that the CIA usually specializes in.
Yeah, that's my understanding too, and that it did grow from the Army and then was later rolled up under JSOC.
Yeah. I wonder if you could comment on the overlapping nature of some of these missions, because when you talk about some of the other JSOC units, even Ranger Battalion, I mean, all these elements have their own reconnaissance capabilities. You know, Dev Group has Black Squadron, Delta Force has Recce guys, Recce troops, Rangers have, you know, even Ranger Battalion has their own SIGINT guys now. How does a unit like ISA fit in today's world and today's special operations structure?
Well, again, you know, in my in my opinion, to a large degree, and from what I've seen, you know, one of the challenges that special operations community has today is they said, you know, they want a Harvard graduate that can win a bar fight. In many ways, I think that you'll find that ISA, you know, candidate would fit a little bit more of that than some of the other units. If you think about, say, Delta, where a lot of people are coming up from Ranger Battalion, maybe through Special Forces. You know, one of the reasons that I created Drake Wolf the way I did is that he was a Ranger tabbed SOT A. And that's something also that you don't hear too much about. Yeah. But these are, you know, the SIGINT communication specialists that are trained to you know, conduct communications intelligence, but then can also engage, especially if you've gone through if you've got the Ranger tab. So in this case, you know, I'm taking of what I think, and I think that this is also something that will evolve more and more as the roles are increasingly technical, is you're going to have to figure out how to groom individuals that are technically savvy and kind of run them up through a ranks where they can, you know, get into a specialized unit like that. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, any of the other special mission units don't have people like that. Not at all. But I think that if you're looking for that specialized type capability to go in, I think that you're going to find that they'll probably need to recruit an increasing batch of those type of people. Now, that's also one of the reasons that I wanted to write about the this and this series of a book, and this is more of kind of a personal matter, was that when I went through Army ROTC in college, everybody was artillery there. So I never really understood what the full gamut was of opportunities for me. And I hold that a little bit begrudgingly because I did have an interest in intelligence. I did have an interest in technology, but nobody could really tell me what that was. So one of the reasons that I also wanted to put this out there was there's a lot of young readers who might be so inclined to look at the military, and I want them to also be able to see, okay, you could be a gamer, you could be a hacker, you can still want to do this type of thing, but let me nudge you a little bit into an area and a bit of a pathway of how you could get into it, which is why I showed some of the backstory of Drake Wolf, the bird dog, in how he, you know, kind of came through the ranks of, you know, the back door, so to speak, into the special operations community and into being able to move up to the tier one. And so there's a number of elements in the story where, you know, people are, you know, ribbing him for being support, which if you talk to any SOT A guys, it's the, you know, the one thing that they absolutely hate hearing is that they're support. But that's, you know, that's what it is. That's how it is. And, you know, he holds his own.
You know, something that a Army Intel friend of mine told me, he's like, you know, for guys like you, talking to me in my case, like guys like you, special operations guys, your pathway is pretty clear and laid out in front of you. That, you know, if you want to go and be a Ranger, there's, you know, you go to the Ranger indoctrination program, you go to Ranger battalion, you do your thing, you go to Ranger school. You know, if you want to keep going, stay in the Army, it's very clear how you go to be a JSOC operator. You go to Delta Force selection, you do the long walk, you go through the operators training course. Like, it's all very clear. But if you're in that intelligence world, it's not clear at all. It's just, you know, if you go into Army Intel and you're a smart guy, you're in good shape, you know, you go past Ranger school or whatever, that you just get sucked up into some program and nobody hears from you again.
Yeah, I agree. And that was one of my gripes, you know, even in what I learned, you know, this is like 25 years now back now in college, intelligence was order of battle. You know, so you're still looking at troop size. They didn't get into a lot of the nitty gritties of what intel could be, what the capabilities were for counterintelligence. And I think that a lot of people who even do go through those schools still find it a little bit challenging to see where they can go. Because, again, you're getting into the element of highly secretive capabilities. Most of the times when you're getting into the signals intelligence side, you're dealing with NSA. And you're taking things to a whole new level, because now all of a sudden you're talking about not only is somebody coming in the secret, the top secret clearance level, being compartmentalized into certain, you know, Redden areas. But then for some, you're going straight into polygraph area.
And it, I mean, I would encourage people, although they are fairly well redacted, if you go and read the INSCOM annual reports that have been declassified from like the 70s and 80s, you can start to glean some ideas of what Army Intelligence Command is up to or has been up to in the past, and see that this stuff is out there. There are some interesting programs, some interesting things going on there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there is, if you do the searches, even for ISA intelligence support activity, FOG, is how it originally, the field observation group, where that kind of derived. That's kind of the pathway that you can get without, you know, anything being disclosed too much.
I wanted to ask you, too, about some of the things that you see in Buried in Black, where you have a intelligence professional who is literally just off the grid. Like in Drake's case, in the protagonist's case, I mean, they fake his death basically. Are there cases like that where things like that actually happen, where it's like, happy birthday, Frankenstein, the old you is dead, and you're literally just a new person? I mean, does stuff like that happen in real life?
I don't know of anything like that. I'll just say this. I have never been asked to bring somebody back from the dead or to, put documents together or anything like that. So whether it happens or not, I've got no idea. I think, and I did think that I addressed that also in the book, where, you know, you've got somebody that's thinking it's such a great idea that we're just going to, you know, kill off Drake Wolf. He'll be able to operate in the shadows like so many of these other novels. And my old hero, Sean Havens, is in there. He's like, are you kidding? That is so stupid, because here you are. You're still going to be living in the U.S. He goes, what are you going to want to do when it's a class reunion? What do you want to do when it's, you know, it's a family dinner or something like that? He goes, you are cut off from everything, and there's really no way that you can escape that unless you are entirely off the grid.
I think, and he even makes that comment that, like, look, if you're going to remain in the intelligence business, you need to capitalize on your relationships with people. How the hell are you going to come back from the dead and ask somebody for a favor, ask somebody for a job or whatever the case is?
And these guys are going to be working still around the Beltway. And so, you know, how is it that you're going to have, you know, Peapod delivering to your house every day? Or, you know, are you not going to ever go into public and see anybody? So those are the types of things. I mean, I think that it's an easy way for us to, you know, make a hero seem like they're operating in the dark a little bit more. But I think what you have more commonly is that individual who is just rolled up into a commercial type activity, and they're able to just, you know, go out, mow the lawn, have a family. That's a lot more plausible than, you know, maybe those onesie twosies that could still be roaming, you know, out in Europe or Africa or Asia. That's, you know, completely off the grid, and that's. You know, it makes great stories.
It's funny because I knew a few people who went to the selection course for ISA. A few of the people who actually got, who became, you know, operators in the unit. I mean, some of them were very smart guys. A few of them were like bacon eating crusader types. It's like, oh my God, really? But, it's funny because sometimes they come back, and the guys who get selected, they come back and they already have this bullshit cover story like, oh, I'm getting out of the Army and going to law school. It's like, no, you're not. Why are you even trying to pull the fleece over my eyes with this?
I saw there's a reason I got to be careful how I phrase this, but there was an individual who was supposedly covered in a U.S. department. Okay. So, you know, maybe one that we might think about in, you know, the upper north or something like that of the U.S. But he was still residing in Washington, D.C. on his LinkedIn profile. And there are just a lot of things that don't match. Yeah. And, you know, one of my jobs was to make sure that something did match. And I think that's still kind of a frustration I have with the community sometimes in slapping these covers together. You know, you get on special roster and someone's like, well, what do we make this person? Well, we plug them into this or that. But if you look at things that they're posting on social media, you know, I think you even reported on that about some of these guys using the run tracking out in the Middle East.
Fitbit, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, here you've got somebody that's posting on social media, just conducted a run, I just did a ride or a swim or something, but it doesn't fit at all what it's saying that they're supposed to be doing. So you've got to fit the cover to their actual pattern of life. And, you know, that's how we made things seamless. All I can say is today you get what you pay for, and there's a lot of GS12s that are doing that work.
I mean, what's your take on, you know, Army or the, or let's just say the Department of Defense trying to do cover? Because I've had people come to me and say that that DOD and JSOC, they don't really know how to do cover at the end of the day, and that's really something that's the purview of the CIA.
You know, I would even say that the CIA struggles. These guys are, you know, JSOC is in the military business. CIA is in the intelligence business. When you're covering somebody, you've got to be in the business. And so you have to understand that to walk like a duck, talk like a duck in the business community, you've got to understand it from that business mindset. You've got to understand there are more cover entities that have been rolled up around the world, not because counterintelligence found them, but because the tax man found them. I've got in Buried in Black, I've got, I think in chapter one, you know, Drake is working on an IBM ThinkPad, but that IBM ThinkPad was like an older version. It had been procured from India and kind of routed up. So even the technology that you're bringing and carrying around, he had to have some old beat up shoes. He had to have pants that weren't, you know, coming, you know, they weren't 5'11s, you know, it's got to look like you're supposed to look like. And I think that's missed because that's hard work. Those are hard details. I think the last time we talked, you know, 2016, I'd shared of how at one point somebody decided, okay, we want to go into this particular country and we're going to kind of put our stuff in a date truck. And we asked, well, what kind of dates are they going to be? Well, what do you mean? What kind of dates are they going to be? Well, are they the type of dates that are imported or the type of dates that are exported? Because if you're bringing certain table dates from this particular country, they're crap. And anybody that says, okay, you're bringing this in, it's going to get the eye of scrutiny. Like, why the hell are you bringing this in? So that's, you know, those type of things. You just got to know the subtle nuances. And in fairness to these elements, they're busy doing what they have to do. And sometimes you have to bring in experts that understand how to make things really work like that pattern of life would be in that country.
I was wondering if we could get a little bit into the actual meat and potatoes of Buried in Black, because I think the plot is very interesting to me in that it's about allies of ours in Iraq that feel we sold them out, and they're retaliating against primarily against U.S. Special Forces here in the United States.
Yeah.
And some of the places you write about in your novel where American SF guys are attacked and Delta operators, you know, retired or current are attacked are places I've actually been and had beers with retired Delta Force operators. And I'm like, holy shit, I know exactly what bar he's referencing down in North Carolina. And, you know, when I've been to some of these places, I've had the same thoughts that clearly you had, that like, holy shit, like for somebody who is up to no good, this is a soft target.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. There are, if I go down to Tampa to see my friends, I know exactly what bars they're going to be in. So does everybody else. Same thing goes with Fayetteville or any other place. People are creatures of habit. And I think that that's the reality of it. And it is really one of our vulnerabilities. So you've got two sides of this. You have one, which is that, you know, by and large, you know, when we go overseas, especially if you're dealing with special forces, you've got some guys that are really culturally minded and really enjoy being enmeshed with those people. And so you make friendships and things do come out. Personal things. And so as I shared in the book, you know, these guys were sharing videos of their family, showing pictures of their family after the war, liking, you know, friending them on Facebook.
Yeah. I'm friends with the Iraqis I trained on Facebook.
Right. and so how many of those Terps, how many of the Mohawks were told, yeah, we're going to get you guys out of here. You guys have helped us. We know that you're in danger. We're going to get your family out. So when somebody's tour is up and they're out of there, somebody else comes in and said, hey, I was promised. You know, where is this at? Where's my paperwork?
Is that something that actually happened? I mean, did they lie to these guys? Because you're writing about dudes who are down in Baghdad. I was up north, so I don't know anything about that. I mean, did we as a country, either officially or informally lie to these guys and tell them we were going to give them, visas to come to the States?
I don't know that that's necessarily policy of what somebody had done, but I know that there's a lot of individuals that made promises because it's just something that you just, you know, just kind of let me see what I can do.
And you,
just
don't something think you'll have to follow through on.
Yeah. I mean, here you're trying to get somebody to help you. And so you're going to say, hey, you know, we're, you know, I need you to help us with X, Y, or Z in your country. And then they're like, hey, but by the way, do you think you can get my family out to the U.S.? You know, we're going to say, no, but still, I want you to do what I'm asking you to do. So we tend to say, yeah, I think I can make that happen. And then what do? They go to somebody from the State Department and say, hey, how do we help these guys out? Well, they'd have to do this paperwork. They'd have to do this paperwork. And so I think oftentimes we give them that, but to really follow through and make it happen, as we know, it doesn't often happen.
Right.
And as we know more stories, there's a lot of innocent people who were butchered. And then those families because of the retaliation. I mean, just think about what would you do?
Right.
You know, if that happened, you'd have an axe to grind. And if somebody gave you that way to get back at someone, which, you know, in this case, the IRGC, Quds Force is being that puppet master, to get the Mohawks back into the U.S.
And that would be my biggest concern, would probably even be a bigger state actor than Iran. But let's just say if you're a country, fuck it. Let's just be real. If you're a country like China and you're about to retake Taiwan, or you're a country like Russia and you're about to invade Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, you might look for some ways that you can sabotage the American response before it ever gets off the ground. And I would be concerned with a major state actor like that going to some of these neighborhoods and communities, like you mentioned in Tampa or North Carolina, where, you know, just before D-Day and H-Hour, maybe you just go and take these dudes out so they don't even have the opportunity to begin responding.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. And it's a serious concern. You know, you mentioned earlier, you know, how well does DOD, or in this case, you know, DIA, really handle creating covert identities and things of that nature? Well, when the National Clandestine Program was starting to be rolled out, where they were going to do human intelligence, you know, that the new process that came out from DIA, I don't know, maybe 6 years back. I was one of the individuals that red teamed that program to show how, even though somebody wouldn't necessarily have to have the list of all the people who were going to be going dark overseas, we could show, based on the pattern of life and how things work, of people moving, putting their houses up for sale, how they were transported by the GSA requirements. We were able to roll up almost half of that network before it even happened by just showing them how China or Russia would be able to identify those people that were coming in overseas and being able to label them right away. So whether it's from overseas or the U.S., yeah, our patterns and our habits are it's a vulnerability.
Plus, with everyone carrying smartphones around, I know there were special operators who were overseas live streaming stuff from Mosul back to their pals in the United States over, you know, open nets just on a smartphone. Yep.
That's what we did that one particular bar that you're talking about, you know, when these guys came in. So the Mohawks understood how to do certain, you know, signals intelligence based on what they were doing in the internet bars. So they were able to pull up all of the phone IP addresses, Mac IDs, and here, you know, you've got these guys who are, you know, tier one, but yet they're in a local neighborhood bar. They're open to using the Wi-Fi. So as soon as something went down, the bad guys were able to triangulate, okay, where are the links now to these phone calls coming in or out? And they recognized that those were going to be you know, the spouses, and from there they're able to track that by just geolocation. So it's, you know, we put it out there.
So, I mean, riddle me this. I mean, what if you're to take pictures, let's say you're to go on DVIDS, where the Department of Defense uploads all their open source photographs, copyright free photographs. If we're to go and look at all the open source Ranger School and West Point graduation photos, these institutions that act as feeder mechanisms for covert programs, pull the biometrics off, run all of that through social media, how many people are going to get popped right off the bat? And has DOD even begun to think about this problem yet?
I don't know that they have, or not to the level that they need to get something done. The one thing that always cracks me up, and I know sometimes I just make some kind of snide comments on Facebook or Twitter, is all the team photos that you operators put of, the bandoleros of, you got the ammunition, you've got, let's all stand out there with a flag and let's stand out there with our weapons and maybe we'll, black eye some people and blackface this guy and put a bar over here.
You guys take a lot of that he can't see over there.
Yeah. Right? You guys take a lot of damn pictures. And I've always wondered, is it, you're going out and say, hey, wait a second, guys, let's, team photo here. And I think that so much of that that's posted out there of, here's the team. It's pretty easy, especially with facial recognition and being able to put those links together, that you could put together a squad very, very easily. I mean, we do it against our foreign adversaries. It's really simple to do.
Yeah, I mean,
we put it out there.
I've done it as a journalist. I mean, when you're working on a story and you have to figure out who's who and, who should I go talk to next? All of those become like little data points. They're little puzzle pieces that you put together. And Instagram especially is heinous. I'm like, some of the stuff on there is shocking that ends up getting posted. I was having a beer once with a retired Delta Force Sergeant Major, and he was like, there are these like Delta fanboys on there on Instagram. And just from looking at photos that have been posted on social media, they've basically cracked the call sign patches that they all wear and understand the organizational structure of the unit. These are like 14-year-old kids decoding call sign patches they're finding on open source photographs. So, I mean, when you have a major intelligence organization like the MSS or the FSB or the IRGC, CUDS Force, whatever the case is, you can only imagine what the hell they've done.
Yeah. And, I think a lot of the reasons that we do post those, for a lot of guys, from the military side do, is look, they've been through a lot.
Yeah,
they're highly trained. They're usually armed to the teeth. And I know that usually that bravado is, yeah, come ahead, come get me. Well, I got news for you. If I'm looking to target somebody, I'm not going for you. I'm not going for the armed guy. I'm looking for the easy fight and I'm looking for the family. And that's where I think it's missed, is if somebody was really that devious, really wanted to do it, they're not going for the hard target. They're going for the soft target.
And
that's what I try to at least put out there in the book is, mind our P's and Q's, folks, because this is a weakness.
And these things aren't happening in a vacuum either. It's not just social media photographs. Our adversaries now have all of the OPM data that they can cross-reference that with. And, how many other hacks and leaks and everything else that has happened over the years is just putting our adversaries into a totally different stratosphere.
Yeah. And that's, again, goes back to Buried in Black, where it started with, some of these guys going through the OPM leaked information that was on the dark web. They were able to take that and then just put these pieces together. So I'm not looking to give anybody a playbook of how to do it. And so there's a lot of, segments that are left out, but it's easy to do. And it's just, hoping to just create a little bit of an awareness. Part of my background comes on the red teaming side, and in a lot of these programs, or hardening these programs. So what I'd like to do now that I'm out is create some of this awareness in these books, not just so much, some people say, well, are you giving away tradecraft? Like, no, I'm trying to tell you from an infrastructure, defense infrastructure standpoint, this is broken and you guys need to fix it. But how do I get it out?
Yeah, no, it's frustrating. I've definitely had people pretty angry with me saying I'm violating OPSEC and I'm giving away OPSEC. And it's like, wait a second, who am I giving away OPSEC to? This is like open source stuff that's out there. Like the enemy knows. So like, who is this information secret from? Is it secret from the bad guys or is it secret from the American public? Like, who are we trying to keep this information from at then at this point?
Yeah. And, you know, that was actually a good experience that I did have. So my books, in this one in particular, I had to run it through DOD. I had to run it through NSA and I had to run it through the CIA. Okay, through all the publication reviews. So everybody got their chop at it and, you know, tell me what they suggested redacting or something that just needed to be taken out. There was only one time that somebody actually reached back out to me and said, we'd actually like to have a discussion about this because we would like to know how to fix this. So,
well, at least they were open to fixing things.
Well, that's it. And so what it was is, you know, it was nice to know because usually you figure, okay, it's somebody that, you know, couldn't get promoted or something. Maybe that's sitting in some of these roles. They're not the sexiest roles. They have to read a bunch of novels and go through and redact them because in many cases they're not, it's not automated. Yeah. They're having to pick things out, but it was nice to know that somebody saw something and said, I need to pass this over to somebody else. And then that person passed it to somebody else and checked it out. And then that person said, let's have a little bit of a chat. And so I'm happy to advise them on how to, you know, take care of this situation that in particular I had addressed. But again, anything that they said, you know, they were a little bit squeamish about, I had no problem taking it out. You know, anything that I put out there, it's usually, you know, when I look at it in isolation, it's, you know, is this classified? Are these any equities that are exposed? No. But, you know, when you seam those two together and you can make analytical inferences, that's usually where somebody might say, hey, you know, I have a little bit of heartburn with it. And that's great because that's part of the process that I'm hoping is going to happen so that those things are grabbed and nothing is disclosed inappropriately. So there may be something close, like a lot of the keywords on some of the systems or something like that, especially the NSA ones, you know, they're out there. But I'll just change them up a little bit just so that it's not, you know, searchable.
Yeah, I noticed that. I think the other thing I wanted to ask you is the characters in all of your books, but this one included, they're definitely different than like what you would find in some of those other books in this genre. You know, like you said, there's not so much flag waving. These are sort of cynical, pragmatic, self-interested actors working within a bureaucracy. And it almost feels like they've kind of lost touch of what it was they got into the game to begin with, or whatever they were fighting for at one point. Like there's just, they've lost track of morality at some point along this journey.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see if you could elaborate on how you develop these characters and what this mentality is, where they come from.
You know, I think a lot of this is just the reality, especially with most of the characters that are in the book that are really seasoned and they've spent a lot of tours on. They deal with the bureaucracy, they deal with the frustration, and sometimes it's the, is it worth it? Or if they know what has to be done to target a certain individual, but they can't get the opportunity to do it, again, you're waiting to cut through a lot of that red tape. Most of the guys that I know, especially a lot of the 18 X-rays that, and I address this a little bit in Prime Charge. Most of the soldiers that I know did not join the military because of a sense of duty, a sense of patriotism.
It's they funny, did you've talked about it, this before.
Yeah, they did it because they thought it was cool. they thought it'd be fun. It was something that was very much of interest to them. A lot of the guys I know, outdoorsmen, hunters, you know, they like that sense of adventure. They like that physicality. They can't see themselves in an office. This seems like a good alternative or a good opportunity.
And so I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's kind of weird how everybody has to be put in this bucket of like, you know, my country called and I served. Like, I think everybody who does do it is heroic, but it doesn't matter. You know, the reasoning behind it, if you serve, you serve. And you've spoken about that before. I remember you jokingly saying, like, I don't really care if civilians thank me for my service. Like, I went for my own selfish reasons.
So. It's true. I mean, I did it because I wanted to do it, because it was important to me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, somebody, but there's a lot of guys when, you know, someone say, hey, thank you for your service. And they're like, you know, I didn't do it to serve you. Yeah. You know, I've got one buddy who just loves it. Absolutely loves it. So in these cases, I think that you've got, well, in Drake Wolf in particular, you know, here's a guy who was young, impressionable. His dad was in the CIA. Something happens to the family. Where does he go? He's going under kind of a hard charging, former operator, was in the Phoenix program, ends up being JSOC J2, you know, so here you've got this guy who's really, you know, very much mission focused, and he's going to get this guy, he's, you know, trying to shape and mold, this young kid into what he wants. Now, Drake's also got some mental issues. And, but because of that and because of the secrets that he's holding, you know, he's not in a position where he can kind of hold back. And so what if you had somebody that really wanted to exploit that and just keeps pushing this kid and keeps pushing him?
Use and abuse him. And
that's right. And because of the clout that he had, he can get him into all of the programs. He can get him into all the qualification things. So he's getting the t-shirts all along the way. And here he's sitting back. I don't really even want to be here, but this is all I know. This is what I do. And that's, I think, and then he's got that war weariness where, you know, he doesn't want to quit because it's not part of him, but yet it's just, he's just dragging. And yet he doesn't want to kill himself for the sense of, he just doesn't want to be there. He just doesn't want to be in the situation that he's in. And I think that's also something that speaks true to a lot of guys that have come back after a lot of tours where that have thought about killing themselves. It's not so much that they didn't want to live. It's just that they don't want to be in that state of mind and that state of physicality that surrounds them. And they want that change, but don't know how to get it. And that's what I also try to weave in there.
Well, I think what came out in the book, or one of the things I noticed, was that the intelligence professionals, if you will, in the book, they treat their subordinates, their fellow Americans, their special operators, almost like, you know, you would expect a CIA case officer to treat a Somalian asset they've recruited, that it's just like I said, use and abuse them, get rid of them, you know, like, you're just here to help me get up a few rungs up the ladder or whatever it is, and then, you know, move on. It's a pretty cynical way to treat our soldiers. And also what comes out in it is, you know, preying on the soldier's sense of patriotism.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of problems, I think, with some of those hierarchies and even some of the interagency involvement on some of these activities. I put out a post the other day. Jack Carr had written something, and I was talking about being in DC. These guys are writing about, you know, their camp stoves and that, and I said, you know, I never had that problem in some of the times at the Ritz-Carlton over in the Beltway or over in McLean. And they're like, I must have been harsh. And I was thinking, you know, actually some of it was harsh from the emotional standpoint of dealing with these policymakers who are thinking of sending somebody downrange or certain taskings for missions that you know are going to trickle down, and you've got somebody that's got, you know, the Velcro patch in the room, or you've got somebody that's got the embroidered monograms on the sleeve, and who do you think they listen to? You know, it's the guy who doesn't have any of the experience, but that's somebody that they relate to or that they hold in a different regard than cannon fodder in many cases. So I think we try to work that also in, and just really from what I've seen on both sides of working in the intelligence community, working with some of the policymakers, how they view the soldiers, and then also being within the soldier mindset doing mission support, thinking back up to the ivory tower of who's tasking them, and you know, are they really thinking about what's going on? And sadly. In many cases, no, they don't. They don't care. It's, you just do it because that's your job.
And I mean, they're also just so far removed from it. I mean, even a colonel, I mean, it just seems like they hardly ever know what's actually going on. They talk a good talk about ground truth, but how many of them actually know it? And it's not necessarily because they're bad officers. It's also just they're physically, geographically removed from the situation that these guys are in.
Yeah, there's a great movie. I think it was called The Traitor. and it had Don Cheadle, Chidley, but he was
Yes, that was a good movie.
Yeah, and so was it Jeff Bridges? Was he like the handler?
I can't remember.
So you've got his handler, this guy's handler. So you've got the DC handler, and he's like getting groceries out of his car, and you know he's getting a phone call. The kids are calling him, and then you've got the operator, you know, the asset who's in Africa or the Middle East, whatever, and he's like looking for some type of a backup and help, and you know he's in a life and death situation. So this guy's like, you know, I really can't do it. I can't talk right now, and it's just such a disparity. I found myself in a similar situation years back where this girl was going into Lebanon to actually sit with Hezbollah, and I remember I'm sitting in an office and I'm looking at my watch and I'm like, am I going to catch my plane back to Chicago or not? You know, and I'm like, I got to get out of there, but I got to help her. And you know, am I going to catch hell if I'm not back? It's two different worlds, you know, and you know, you just have to do the right thing and trust that somebody else is.
That's got to be a weird feeling. In a sense, it's like I was thinking about this the other day in regards to another situation. Like, what's the end state for people in this kind of business? Like, we all are very familiar, I think, at this point with, like, you know, special operations soldiers getting deployed over and over again, and they come back and they have all these issues with PTSD. I mean, what's it like for a dude who's running intelligence support and, you know, you're in these stressful situations, there's lives on the line. I mean, do you end up developing PTSD or some other like psychological trauma from just living that lifestyle over a prolonged period of time?
I don't know that I was ever in as much of that as many others, you know, that probably have, you know, more intense experiences from that standpoint. But I will say there's a certain disappointment. When I stopped doing the mission support work and work for the intelligence community, it wasn't up to me. It was during a time of sequestration. There was a lot of cutbacks. I wasn't living in D.C., so people weren't going to be flying me out back and forth from Chicago, and I wasn't going to move. I wasn't able to move. So what type of jobs are there for a guy like me? And I thought that I would be able to walk into consultancy or a bank and be able to say, I know exactly where the dirt is, you know, where the bones are buried, because we've tracked the money. We know the players. I will help you root this out. And they said, no.
Hey, you want a contract in Yemen? I might be able to hook that up for you.
but the banks didn't want they didn't want anything discovered, because then it would go into a compliance situation. Yeah. They could get fined. There was a number of times where I was on projects and I was told to, you know, these guys are spending millions of dollars looking for some illicit activity, and I was able to just go back through the court cases and see who some of the inquiries were about, some of the allegations were. I was able to map the whole network, and I said, look, we've got it. We can do a search right through here. You guys can put together a database. We can find out this whole network. And they said, yeah, but if we did that and we didn't do this data input for the next year, that's a difference between a $200,000 project and a $2 million project.
Cutting down the billable hours.
So, you know, that's where the frustration really comes. And that's where you do, you know, you want to be part of the mission, but necessarily can't. And that, I think that was harder for me. It's one of the reasons that I kept writing. It's why I started doing some contracts with some, you know, service disabled veteran owned companies and working with them, because there's a certain connectiveness. And I think that there's also something in the corporate world where, you know, there is no loyalty. There is no bond. There's a lot of the backstabbing. You just don't have that same, that mission mindset. So in my, you know, day-to-day life, I do a lot of work with this group called InfraGuard, which is an infrastructure protection between the commercial world and the FBI. And I'm able to act as kind of a segue, because I can talk to the intel analysts, but I can also talk to the commercial people. You know, I get a lot out of that.
That's cool.
And so that's kind of a good balance.
Well, what's next for, I mean, I know it's a little early since the book is just out, but what's next for your writing projects? Is Drake going to get another book, or is there anything else you're working on?
Yeah, this is a 3-book deal. Drake is going to be still dealing with IRGC, but you know, in the second book, The Presence of Evil, you know, what happens if a Hezbollah operative actually gets that, you know, dirty bomb, the WMD, but what if the handlers in Iran realize, okay, if this actually goes off, we're screwed.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, these guys are now having to send in a bunch of their operators to take out the Hezbollah network that they, you know, have now thought, okay, this is a problem. We don't want to have more sanctions. So we don't want to ever tell.
It turns into like a 3-way fight.
That's right. And yet at the same time, you've got Drake, who and his team are looking at it from, we're getting some signals here that the Iranians are sending in more operators. We got to take them out. So I think that'll be pretty interesting. I've just turned in that manuscript, so that's in editing. And then the third one that I'm really excited about doing, and Jack, you and I, you know, sat over a number of beers talking about this too, was it's called what the hell is it even called? Collision Course. And in this thing, it's going to be focused on Robin Sage. And how you've got qualification course and that whole wilderness of mirrors of not knowing what is real, what is not. Well, what if somebody exploits that? And if there's a murder in Pineland? And so I'm going to throw my guys in the middle of that mess and see if we can have some fun with that type of confusion that could be.
Yeah, I think last time I told you the story about the teams that accidentally go into their E&E corridors and the cadre don't see them for like 2 or 3 days until they're able to catch up with them. But yeah, hit me up about that down the line, and I might be able to put you in touch with some people who work either volunteer or work out there at Sage and some of the other courses. Pineland people maybe can help you out with the research a little bit.
And that'd be great. I mean, you know the books that I write. I'm not able to quit the day job. I'm not making millions of dollars off these. I just want to have fun. I want the guys that have kind of been there, done that, to read them, have a smile, and say that's kind of cool. I don't think anybody's ever done, you know, a Robin Sage
story. Murder mystery, yeah.
So I figured, you know, let's have some fun with that. So there's so many of the Green Berets out there that can look at it and say, holy crap, I could have seen that thing happening. You know, we thought the same thing, or wasn't that fun? And to mess with that, just because, I just want somebody to be entertained that's a little closer to it than otherwise.
Kensington has some heavy hitters, too. I mean, we've had A.J. Tata on the podcast, former Marine. Oh, no. I'm thinking of Anderson Harp, former Marine, A.J. Tata, former Army Brigadier General. So it's kind of weird because I went to their little like banquet that they had. It was actually Tony Tata who invited me. And there's a lot of like romance novels on Kensington. But then there's like this niche group of guys who do what you do.
Bromance books.
Yeah. You know, it's all in the editors. John Gilstrap writes some great ones. He's got a Delta character that they're pretty good stories. And of course, Mark Cameron had written a lot of books for there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, they have their niche. And, you know, the one thing about each of these publishing houses is they all want to have like their guy, you know, they're one guy who's going to go up against, you know, a Mark Green or a Brad Taylor or whoever, you know, so who's your guy? And I think in, you know, like where I'm coming in through Lyrical, I think it's kind of like being in, you know, somewhat in the minor leagues of, okay, let's see if these guys, you know, if we throw them against the wall, who's going to stick and who can be that next person. So I'm just happy to have the opportunity to work with some of these guys. All the guys over at Kensington are great. And really, and as you well know, Jack, and you too, with, you know, being on the radio shows, everybody in the military thriller community, for the most part, is really kind of fun to be around.
Yeah.
And there's some great guys out there. There's a lot of give and take. Josh Hood and I, you know, speak almost daily, just bouncing ideas back and forth.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
So, you know, there's some great folks out there. Mark Greeny has been fantastic. I just feel like, you know, what I missed leaving that the mission support, the intelligence community, I've kind of gotten it back in the military thriller community, just because you've got so many like-minded people, whether they served or not.
Hey, entirely off topic, but for the people watching the YouTube video, which, you know, most people just listen to the audio, but I'm just curious, what is that, like sports memorabilia behind you? I've been trying to figure out what it is.
I've got, let's see. So I'm in Chicago here. So we've got.
I was thinking there was something Michael Jordan. I saw the red.
We've got street names up there. We've got Clark, Waveland, Sheffield back over the air hockey table. We've got all the Hawk stuff. We've got some Bulls things over there. We've got other Cubs things. We've even got the Christmas tree up.
Oh, wow, that's early. Snap. And we're recording this pre-Thanksgiving day. So,
to the man cave.
Yeah, we like our Chicago sports around here.
Nice. That's very cool. I was just curious. But so follow JT Patton on Twitter at JT Patton Books, JTPATTEN Books, JTPattonBooks.com, and pick up the new book, Buried in Black. It's out, like I said, today as we're recording it, out this week. I guess as you're out Black Friday shopping, or you know, most likely just on Amazon, pick it up.
This is it's good holiday reading, good book to get as a gift, Christmas gift for a family member that's into either espionage or counterterrorism, you know, military thrillers. It'll be up their alley. Like I said, I'm 200 pages into it. I'm going to finish reading it over the next day or two. It's definitely worth picking up.
Yeah, I think it's something at least different. You know, I wouldn't put myself in the class of some of these great writers, but I think I tell a fun story. It's something different. It's a unique vantage into the JSOC community if you haven't seen it. So, you know, give it a try just to see if that might be something else that piques your interest. I don't think it gets too bogged down in the technical stuff either.
No, I think it's a very interesting, unique take. And I think if our listeners go and read it, I think they'll come back to us and have a bunch of additional questions they're going to want to ask you.
Well, that sounds good. You know, happy to answer any questions or hit me up on social media, and especially about the microdosing.
Nice. Well, hopefully we have you back on. I mean, the last time we had you on, as we were saying, a couple of years back, so it's been a while. And I'm glad that we did this again, and I'm sure we will in the future as you're working on new stuff. And it's just cool to see you pumping out these books. As you said, it's not your full-time job, and yet you're still making the time to continually do this, and people love them.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate y'all having me on.
Yeah, thank you. We'll do it again soon.
See you guys. Have a good holiday.
All right, you too. Take care.
Appreciate it. All right, so wrapping things up here, guys. Be sure to check out Crate Club, that collaboration watch we did with NFW Watches. Jack has it, or you're not wearing it today. You've worn it before. But we have different tiers of membership depending on how prepared you want to be, and gift options are available as well. The guys from the Loadout Room and Scott Whitner have a lot to do with what we're putting out there. 2019, it's going to be all custom products entirely. It's a club for men, by men. You could check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us. If you're a dog owner, doesn't matter the size of your dog, Kuna has a custom-built box for your dog, so it doesn't matter the weight or the breed. They'll hook it up for you, and that's our monthly box that we've partnered with Kuna for. So that's kuna.dog, C-U-N-A.D-O-G. It's efficient, and your dog's going to love it, and it's easier for you. You know, just every month you're getting these great treats and training aids in the mail, stuff like probiotics for your dog, which is, you know, great, keeping your dog healthy. And then as a reminder, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel. That's our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops Channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops Channel. That's at specopschannel.com. $4.99 a month. Really can't beat that for all the content. And I'm sure many of you are enjoying a nice four-day weekend, so I hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving day and are enjoying this post-Thanksgiving day. I am not going to lie. You guys watching the video may have noticed I'm getting a little antsy here because recording two shows.
Are you getting antsy in your pantsy?
I am. I'm fidgety right now because we've been sitting down for like, I don't know, a good 4 hours almost at this point. So
yeah, we have.
We've recorded a lot.
Yeah, we knocked out two podcasts in one day so we'd have an original episode for you guys over Thanksgiving while we're out having our holiday too.
Yeah, I just noticed it's a lot for me to sit down this long because I think even when I worked on long shows prior to this, you know, there's commercial breaks. I'm walking around. I couldn't tell you the last time I've just sat down this long and I'm like, I'm ready to get up and start moving
fucking
around.
Fucking millennials. You're all ADD.
How much older are you than me? I'm 32 years old.
I'm 35.
I saw the topic of Zennial. Have you seen people put that out online?
No.
They said that, so I'd technically be a Zennial. We're like the last people who grew up like, without the smartphone. I think we're all in the same category as well.
Yeah. I think we talked about it before. Like, I had a Walkman, I had cassettes. I mean, my parents had a record player.
We saw the blue screen Macintosh. I remember all that
The
stuff.
Green screen.
Yeah, the green screen and then the blue screen. Yeah. I think,
Oregon Trail.
I couldn't imagine, though, growing up, like, social media immediately. I mean, like your daughter. It's interesting. But anyway, as I said, I'm not going to lie, getting fidgety here. I need to move around. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode and the last episode. And we'll be back on, Wednesday. We'll have a new episode up. We have some great people coming on. Awesome. We have a Gold Star sister coming on. And Quint Emerson will be back on for the first time in a while. Then we have another week of shows. And then I am off to Florida for a week. And I'm going to make, I already know what I'm going to do, I think. We did some great stuff for Power of Thought that a lot of you guys have never heard. So I think I'm going to play some of that, including what I believe is probably the last interview Captain Jerry Yellen did, who flew the final mission over Japan. And Brandon interviewed him on the Power of Thought. It's like a perfect soft rep interview. So I think we'll put it on there.
I was going to suggest, just coming to the gym and recording me working out, but that's actually a lot better.
Yeah, that would be cool. So I'll put that up. And it's just such an interesting story that his son then married a Japanese girl from Japan. And that whole story of kind of like a coming together of two cultures. And
I want to listen to this myself. It sounds like that Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah, it sort of is. And then shortly after that interview, Jerry Yellen passed away. So it was just great to get him on the show. I remember Brandon. So Jerry Yellen was still like flying around in his 90s. And Brandon invited him to come, in the plane and everything. And he was like, yeah, I'm all for it. He was like, can I still do barrel rolls and all that? And he was all up for it. But unfortunately couldn't, take him up on that offer because, like I said, just a few months later, he passed away. But it was a great interview. So I think I'll use that. I may use, like, the CJ Ramon that we did in the Power of Thought. But anyway, we're wrapping up November and then December. And the new year is right around the corner, as crazy as it is.
Yeah. I mean, this is a crazy time of the year. It always is, at least for me. A podcast, like I said, I mean, we're becoming a hot item. We got a lot of guests scheduled in.
Yeah. There's like so many people I need to get. And then Brandon will email me, get this guy on the podcast, you too. And I can only get people in the new year.
Yeah, there's more people trying to get in than we can schedule, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then on top of that, I get the emails of, you got to get this guy on, you got to get this guy on. And a lot of them are good. There's only so much we could do. Unless this was like a daily show.
You come up with some people too who I'm kind of skeptical about at first, but like they almost always turn out to be great. Like when we had Ricky Poe on, that you know from the gym, and like
he was fun.
Yeah, I didn't know I didn't know him. I had no idea what to expect, but he was awesome.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy. So yeah, I mean, if someone is interesting, we'll have them on and they're a part of this community. And I think generally, I mean, there hasn't been a show in a long time where I've been like, I wasn't a fan of that. I think we've been pretty consistent lately. You never know, because sometimes you get people on who have never done podcasts before,
and they get a little nervous.
But we've seen people I think warm up, like even Jeff DePazzi from JTF.
That was a great one.
Yeah, I think the first few minutes he was a little bit iffy, and then he got comfortable. Cool. All right, well, I'm just stalling here because I want to hit our outro and wrap this up for you guys, but there we go. As always, appreciate you guys checking this out. And leave a review on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Hope you enjoyed. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at SoftRep Radio. I don't say it often enough, so you can follow Jack on Twitter at Jack Murphy RGR, on Instagram at Jack McMurph. You can follow me on Twitter at Ian Scotto. And that's really it. We're going to have new Power of Thoughts coming up soon as well. So if you're not subscribed to that, subscribe there as well. And that's about it, guys. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.